My name is Tamani Brown, and I'm currently in the Shabazz Center in Hanover, New Hampshire. I'm doing a Zoom interview with Eileen Cave. Eileen, where are you right now?
I am residing in Hyattsville, Maryland.
Okay, Eileen is in Hyattsville, Maryland. Today is October 26, 2021, and this interview is for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. So first of all, again, thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me. It means a lot, and I'm excited to just get whatever information I can from you.
Absolutely. Glad to participate.
Okay. So first, can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born December 21st, 1955 in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay. Pretty close to Christmas.
Yeah.
This question isn't really related to the interview at all, just because I found out. Were you like one of those kids who, you know, your parents wouldn't give you birthday and Christmas gifts?
It's two separate days and my children. And when a friend says to me, here's your combined Christmas birthday gift, I ask them, what do you want on Christmas? Your birthday gift or you? So I do not know what I'm saying. It's how you own it that drives that.
Okay. So coming from Brooklyn, can you talk a little bit about what it was like growing up there?
Sure.
And first, sorry, not to cut you off, but what part of Brooklyn are you from?
My location, it was and then was considered Brown, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Crown Heights, but it was between Eastern Parkway and Atlantic Avenue. So now to go on my block, in fact, I was just home on the block this summer. So it was an area that, you know, I just enjoyed growing up in immensely. It was inner city. I had a cousin across the street. So my father was a dentist. His father was a doctor and they were best friends growing up. So I just grew up in an area where I would be playing street ball and stoop ball during the weekdays. And then we drive out to Long Island on the weekends and I'd go fishing and clam digging through the sandbars. So I had a very interesting contrast of experiences when I was growing up.
That definitely does sound interesting. You know, you don't really expect a lot of people from Brooklyn to talk about going fishing on the weekends.
Much less baiting a hook and not being squeamish.
Yeah. So what high school did you go to? Was it in Brooklyn?
Yes, I went to Wingate High School. It was shaped like a banjo. It is no longer standing. I forget what year they demolished it, but it was interesting because there were several of us from Wingate High School that were in the first class of women.
Okay. And was this a public school or private school?
A public school. Yes, I was in public school all the time growing up before coming to Dartmouth.
And how did you hear about Dartmouth or how did you get to apply?
Well, so I guess I should back up and say that I was 16 when I was a senior in high school. So I was looking for an opportunity to travel away from home, be a good distance away from home. I wanted to be off on my own. And recruiters, as I recall, came from Smith, Holyoke, Rutgers, Dartmouth. Those were just the schools I can recall that I applied to and got into, but Dartmouth was the most interesting to me when I heard everything about it and that we would be the first class of women. And I thought that that was a very interesting, intriguing, and challenging opportunity in itself. And then, of course, the school's reputation as an Ivy League.
So, you know, being in that first class of women, you mentioned that it was a challenge. Were you ever like intimidated or did you like take the challenge head on?
Well, so I think, you know, when you look at it in the context of coming from New York and being so young, I would say that there was a naive unawareness of just what it meant to be in that first class. So clearly there was a 10-to-1 ratio. You knew that there would be a lot more men than there were women. And so I wouldn't say it was ever necessarily intimidating. Being from New York up in Hanover, the contrast of just what that small town was like, especially in the 70s, Hanover in the 70s is nothing like it looks now. So you almost have to dial back to coming in, you know, into that situation, driving up there through the mountains, through the granite, you know, it's granite of New Hampshire, and then getting to that small town and then into, I lived in the Choates at the time. And so it was more of an adjustment of extreme contrast. And I think that that would probably be the most accurate way to characterize every aspect of the experience from that very, you know, beginning.
Okay. So, you know, Dartmouth coming in, it was originally like, you know, all male school. So, you know, being in the first class of women, obviously you faced some challenges, like you said before. So I wanted to ask, how were you treated by the men on campus?
So because I was interestingly, you know, underage, 16, I had a few what I call big brothers at the time. So these were guys who were friends. And, you know, I just have, and to this day, remain close friends. And I felt more of that kind of a support than I did anything else. I had one guy that I dated the whole time up there, who I'm still seeing now. And it was more of enjoying the independence and freedom of being up there and the resources. And, you know, I at that point, I knew I wanted to be a visual arts major, the, you know, venues at the Hopkins Center. For me, it was more of almost like just being in a free and expansive and enjoyable situation. And so my experiences, and I know that when I talk to some of my classmates, people years later, I almost feel like I was almost in a bubble because some of the things that people were dealing with that were a little bit more harsh or negative, that was not my experience.
So, you know, I mean, it kind of sucks that I have to say this, but I am happy for you that you didn't have to go through that, even though, you know, a lot of people always talk about like the rampant misogyny that was on campus. I'm really glad that you didn't have to feel that.
Let me just say, and I also have to kind of paraphrase this. If you ever look at the photos of what I looked like, I had these dark glasses that were shades. I wore them night and day. And because I was from New York, I was not used to speaking to people in the street. So when I would walk down, I really didn't even notice people or nobody spoke to me. So I got a false reputation of being, oh, she's from New York. You know, she thinks she's cool. She doesn't speak to people. So I think that I might have projected a much harsher, intimidating image than was my intention. So I have to be honest about that. And so I think that that helped some of it, that helped part of it. And then my big brothers on the campus were, you know, like a third of the football team. So I also think that that helped as well. And, you know, I would look at it and say that it was more of an opportunity of, you know, and you're spending most of your time on your academics. I mean, you know, you're going to the football games, you're going to the events that were at the hops and the parties. And at that time, it was the year when the Alphas were just forming their line. So there was really no Black fraternity stuff really active the way it had, you know, been established with multiple Black fraternities afterwards. So did not go. I have never been on frat row. I never attended a party on frat row. And I was also, think about the politics of the 70s. And I really stress when we look at that time, that there was a militancy and advocacy. We had just gotten past, you know, the 60s. And so that kind of view and coming into an institution like Dartmouth was an influencing factor on how you looked at the world and how you saw the world. And New Dartmouth was very different. Different from Brooklyn, different from New York, different from certainly the environment and the lifestyle I grew up in. So I think
understand.
that helps to shape. And then I also became fast close friends with Judy Redding and with Karen Turner. And it was kind of the three of us, solidified. We all lived in and just became fast friends. We joined the Black cheerleaders, the first Black basketball cheerleading squad. We were in that together. They were managers of the team as well. So I think that those kinds of activities just really kind of filled the time and filled the void before we really got into the politics of things. I was the first woman to be president of the African American Society. So when you talk about, you know, misogyny, I would say, hey, they elected me the first president of the AM. So I had brothers come up and challenge me and ask me why I thought I should be elected president. And when I responded, it must have been sufficient because I did have support to serve in that office and in that capacity. So I looked at it as more of a time of Black feminism and empowerment than necessarily the negative attributes of what pushed back, because it was also part of the pushback in the greater society outside of Dartmouth.
I think that's fantastic. And you know, you mentioned being like the first woman president of the AM. That's already, you know, a huge feat in and of itself. I wanted to ask, what kind of work did you do with the AM?
So I think that at the time we were looking to establish the organization and the support for it. So that would have been the spring of 74. It was about the holding the regular meetings. It was about the issues. And the other thing that was happening around the same time is that the Black Alumni of Dartmouth Association was starting to formalize their activity. So there was an increasing presence on campus of the older Black alumni who in my realm of understanding Dartmouth and the influence of Dartmouth, I would credit those alumni as having more of a formative influence and positive influence on me. And so when I say that, that would be Garvey Clark, Gene Booth, Dick Fairley, Fritz Alexander. Those were the Black alumni from the 50s, 49, 50s that first held the offices in Beta and also put on the first conference. So I think that the whole focus was on the Black community coming together to address the concerns of Blacks and Black students on campus. So I think the AM and the students having that focus with the support of the alumni, that was the direction that the organization was moving towards. And that support was needed because there were issues with co-education, I'm not gonna lie. There were some issues between Black men and Black women on campus and disrespect and respect and, you know, the off-campus women versus the sisters on campus. So all the microcosms of just young people in a social setting, as artificial as Dartmouth was, or as much of a contrast as it was to our communities back at home, all those things were in the mix. So I think that the political activism, I also want to say it was also around the same time that for South Africa and the issue of divesting from South Africa, that might've been part of what was playing around the same period as well. So there were a lot of forces about dealing with the college as an organizing group of Black alumni, and then the role of support that the Black students needed and wanted, and our role in that process as well. So those things were kind of all happening in, you know, from 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, in that period of time.
Okay. With the work that the AM, Black students in general, and, you know, the Black Alumni Dartmouth Association were doing, were Black faculty involved with that too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so this is the thing, you know, and again, I'm turning back memories from 50 years, but I think of people like the Nelsons, Joan Nelson, Dean Nelson, And her husband, who was one of the professors of history, Errol Hill, was also a very active person in certainly with the Caribbean. So yes, in the arts, definitely well known internationally, but then also in supporting Black students on campus. Nels Armstrong, who was at the time on staff, you know, Nels was always had our back and made sure that we were trying to academically hold things together and stay focused. So when I look at even the Black alumni that were faculty members at that time, you know, they all played an integral part, really trying to ensure that we stayed focused with all the stuff that was going on the fact that we were there to do well academically, and we got what we needed in terms of emotional support to graduate on time, and to make sure that the support for the Black faculty as well was there when we had the focus and the voice of the Black alumni of Dartmouth as well. So it was all related, is really a reflection of it.
Okay, so I've heard a lot of other alumni and in like some of the research I've done, the name Errol Hill comes up a lot. Can you tell me a little bit more about him specifically?
So Professor Hill, his daughter Dega Hill was my roommate when I lived in Chicago for a period of time. So, I mean, I know the family from that side, but he was just such a talented man in terms of what he did in the arts and internationally recognized. In theater and just the dance and just the whole cultural aspect. So because my family's history is from Barbados, my two grandfathers are from Barbados, I kind of look at the historical legacy and perspective of who we are and who we come from and where our families come from as a very vital story in identity as we look to build our own sense of identity through what we know about our family. And so I looked at Errol Hill as somebody who was so respected and well-known in his own work in the arts, but he also worked very hard at capturing, I think, and documenting the papers, the materials of what that Black experience was like from his side as a professor, from the experiences of the students. And so years later, decades after he had passed away, I became aware of just his papers and a lot of his materials, the wealth of things that he really left to the college and left as his legacy of capturing what went into that experience. So, you know, I was in visual arts and not so much the theater and the dance part of it, but certainly to appreciate when somebody is recognized on the global stage for their contributions in the arts, that's something to be very proud of. So we all had a sense of pride for what his contribution and his talent brought to the Dartmouth community.
You sound fantastic. You sound like a fantastic person.
Absolutely.
So you brought up earlier that, you know, during your time, the Alphas had just started like coming to camp, like,
and had to pledge their line down in Boston. So they couldn't even pledge campus.
So when you say they pledged in Boston, was it like a chapter separate from Dartmouth, or was that the Dartmouth chapter, but they just weren't allowed to do it on campus?
That I do not falsely give Alpha history. I believe that because they were the first established, they were trying to establish the first chapter at Dartmouth, they were required to pledge in Boston.
Okay. And
interesting, and this is my recollection of history, but we also, the women wanted to start, I believe we were trying to start the AKAs, and we were actually discouraged because of the 300 Blacks, 30 were women in that first class. And they felt that it would be unhealthy for us to establish a sorority because it would further fragment the very small group of women that was on campus. So I thought it was kind of interesting that while the guys went ahead and had their chapter established and they did it successfully, The fraternity, the Alpha fraternity was able to be established, that the women's and the interest in our sorority and having a sorority, that was discouraged. So I never really got the full story when I would try to talk to Black alumni and faculty later as to who exactly was discouraging it and who actually was fueling that opposition. But I just know that when we did, you know, when we got pushback, we just really didn't pursue it. But that was to me was an interesting kind of example of, well, it was okay for the guys to establish their chapter, but yet the women couldn't or were discouraged.
So did you ever see any, like, I guess, fragmentation with the men who pledged Alpha and with the ones who didn't, since they...
So for me at the time, you know, the person I was dating at the time, Ben Bridges, was one of the original chapters founders. I saw their effort at trying to organize, to be of service. And I saw it more as something that they had, at least the guys that were on that line, had as a positive experience. You know, I mean, so the negative side of it, I wouldn't say I was aware of it, but then because I'm not a male and was not in a group that may not have been part of it, I think I don't think that I really had the view to know what that response might have been from a male perspective. For me, you know, it was, you know, for me as a Black politically activist person, I thought having a Black fraternity on campus was a great thing. I mean, you know, coming from New York, coming from a network of friends and family who were all over the country, Black fraternities, particularly at the time, you know, family and friends at Howard University and other places, it was like a whole big thing. And so to see that happen and be established in Hanover, I thought was positive, but I was also aware that there were negative aspects of it. So I think you have to kind of look at it and say, you know, for me, the identity of Black political activism was more of the attraction. You know, the African-American society, you know, was more of the bringing together the community. So I gravitated towards the value and the importance of Black activism and political activism. So a little less on the fraternities or sororities, but I, you know, did understand that they played a valuable role. And with that one chapter, I don't think there was as much issue that there might have been in years after I was there, you know, where there might have been some friction. But that was not something I was aware of.
Yeah. So to talk about more, I guess, politically directed things, Judy Redding and Monica Hargrove wrote Institutional Racism and Student Life at Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. So first about that, I wanted to ask, was there any specific event that kind of like sparked you guys and made you think enough is enough? We're going to finally try to write something about this.
So I kind of put the focus more on the course that Judy took. There was a visiting professor, and I'm not sure I couldn't remember where he came from, but he was teaching a class on institutional racism. And so I always find it, you know, academically ironic that the class that the school offered was really the impetus for the training, where Judy basically says, well, you know, I'm taking this class and, you know, these are the symptoms of institutional racism. These are the kinds of things that are going on here. And, you know, and we were sharing experiences. Plus, you know, we're talking with the fellas and the folks on the football team, and we're talking to Black faculty. And so our informal conversations with the various networks, because Monica, Judy, and myself, even though we were friends, I would definitely say that our network of friends was very different, because there were so many, you know, they were more interested in government. I was in the visual arts side. Karen, who was also close to us, was, you know, she was part of a group, you know, just for network as well. So I think that we had a very eclectic mix of issues, concerns, and personal experiences with professors that, I mean, you know, I'll never forget when I had some, you know, one professor draw a bomb on my paper with a line going down because he said, well, you know, your writing style and this and that. And you know, and so, you know, you were wondering, well, what are some of the experiences that I'm having when I'm in a class? Plus, most of the classes were very small at that time. You know, and you'd go through an experience and, you know, sometimes you'd, you know, everybody would look at you and expect you to be the voice of all Black people or, you know, some of the experiences that we all had being in Hanover. You know, we just had great conversations around the things that we were struggling with and I guess really just trying to find solace and support amongst each other. So that was really, it was almost like the perfect storm. It was the perfect storm for us saying we need to formally, you know, organize these concerns. We need to raise them. And I think there was at that time really a naive assumption that in doing so, in going through this process, there would have to be a response and things would change. Because think about what the 70s were like. Everything was being, you know, confronted. New, you know, systems, affirmative action was really getting challenged. And, you know, even the whole admission situation at Dartmouth and other schools, other Ivy League institutions was being questioned and challenged. You know, the attrition, retention of Black students, of Black faculty. So all those things are going on. And I think that that was the mix that just made it necessary for us to move forward with that writing of that report.
I understand. I definitely understand. So the professor that Judy took the course with, did he ever like assist you guys with this piece while you were writing it?
To my knowledge, no. To my knowledge, the timing of it, I think followed, you know, we were started working on it, but I am not aware of that. I mean, when I was working on it, it was more the research, the information that we would get in talking to administration. But I don't know that I don't remember Judy ever describing or engaging that professor in the process that we were undertaking.
Okay. Because
the whole idea was, I guess, you know, we felt that if we researched it, if we gathered the data, if we summarized it, if we organized it, there was just not the thought that there needed to be a more formal area of power and support to stand behind it. We didn't actively seek out or ask Black alumni, you know, to act, you know, to support us in it. And I think that in retrospect, and at that time, the Black Alumni of Dartmouth organization had not, or was in its fledgling situation. We just saw it as a group of students, concerned students formally raising issues that based on what we've learned about, you know, or what we've articulated as the symptoms of institutional racism, it's happening here. And hello, we just want to flag this out and we want a response. So, but I'm saying, you know, I was 16, 17, they were 18. So in our youth and our enthusiasm, you know, I guess we move forward how, you know, the wheels begin to turn.
So thinking about like responses to it, how did the Black community at Dartmouth respond to the piece? And how did Dartmouth in general respond to it?
So I think that your question has a couple of stages in it. To answer it, I mean, the response does. So when we presented the report, there was a trustee committee that was formed that actually Karen Turner was part of because they wanted to have a student on it. And when I talked with Karen, she would often share that there was almost a disbelief or a reluctance in that their committee meeting to even consider that the things that we were raising and talking about in the report were even possible at Dartmouth. So I had an interview after that with the Praxis, And I very publicly said how disappointed I was in the response. They basically blew us off. You know, it was basically like, well, we looked into it. You know, we really don't find any basis for these accusations or concerns. And that was that. So, you know, again, I asked, well, if you read the report and you look at many of the challenges that the school has encountered over the decades, how is it that similarities still exist? If not, the patterns and the symptoms of institutional racism are pervasive, you know? So I think that things do change, things have changed. You know, we're through so many different administrations since the 70s, but I look at it and say that the experience I got from doing that report is if you research something or you have concerns and it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And that kind of process of just being courageous and challenging and being an advocate, just from that experience, I always credit at such a young age, it became an ingrained part of who I was and who I have been as a person, regardless of what field or industry or profession I've been in. And so I do credit it for, you know, making my bones in that respect, that it was an experience that I didn't really think about in those terms at the time, but I look at the patterns of the things that I've always been involved in and how I've raised my children, even what my kids are doing. And I say, you know, it was in your blood, and you found a group of friends and people that shared those concerns. I think it's interesting because only our three names appeared in the report. And it was not because we wrote it alone. We had other people who helped write sections. But when it came down to putting our names on the paper, I think that there were many who were older and some might say wiser at the time, who said, you know, we're going to let you guys sign it, and we're not. So I've had alumni say to me, well, how did you feel? And, you know, did you? Well, when we stood on the steps of Baker Library before we went in to meet with the trustees, and I have that picture, you know, kind of faded from the newspapers, and we were supported by the community. And I think that the community rallied around us. I think they visibly showed that they supported the act, you know, what we were doing, the act that we were presenting this and bringing these issues to the college. And from that standpoint, I think when it counted, there was public and visible support for what we did. And that's really how I, you know, look at it in retrospect, you know, decades later.
Okay. So one, in like near the beginning of the report, you guys wrote, sorry, I'm trying to remember where I wrote the quote. I wrote it, okay. There are ways in which the traditions of Dartmouth have developed into patterns of discrimination. So I wanted to ask, do you remember any specific instances of like a tradition, I guess, transforming into discrimination on campus?
Well, when I think of the traditions, and so there were two pieces of it. There was the traditions established by an all-male school. You know, I think that that had some of it. And at the time, an all-male school that was predominantly white. So, I mean, you know, I think at that time we were looking at, you know, the organization, societies, the network, the structure, the culture. And it was all those things that, you know, we didn't see ourselves in that tradition and in those practices. So for myself personally, I think that, you know, there's always the challenge that Dartmouth has, and I say to this day, that a tradition, because something has been a tradition that began in a period in time, does not necessarily mean that that tradition should be continued without really evaluating, is it inclusive? Is it reflective of the institution and the values that we now hold today. You know, I know that when I worked with the iconographic work group on campus, and we were looking at public art, we were looking at some of the other issues that came up, even with the weather vane, that was another situation. So many times, I'm even meeting some of the Dartmouth alum, even when I came back to the Maryland area, and you go to Dartmouth functions, I'm talking about general chapter functions, general groups here. There was an experience at Dartmouth that so many of them cherish and value that was not inclusive, not diverse, but it was their love of history and love of the college. And I think that when we question the perpetuation and continuance of things that were exclusive, lack diversity, whatever, that was when the rift and the rub began to take place. And so I think that, you know, with leadership, with a lot of the things that are happening now, and also all the groups, special interest groups that have formed on campus, that there is, you know, there is, things have evolved somewhat. But I think that, you know, certainly there are students to this day right now on campus, and you can, you know, give me your view of it, that still feel that some of those traditions are not necessarily inclusive and something that you feel a part of. So I think the, you know, the whole challenge is, you know, the institution of Dartmouth represents so much rich history and legacy. And then it also has the issues that do not speak of a history of necessarily treating people, you know, equitably. And so that's really why I look at, you know, this whole situation and say, well, we have to be the voice, we have to be that voice. So that's really, you know, I kind of see the patterns of things that still exist, but I also see that some things have changed. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting situation, because in 2022, we will have the 50th anniversary celebrations for the Black Alumni of Dartmouth, for coeducation. And it will just be interesting to see how, when this whole portrayal of the lens of history of Dartmouth and accountability, you know, comes forward, that the view, the presentation, and the collective experiences that are presented really do represent the challenges and the struggle of those voices that are all part of it in consideration with that tradition. You know, what are some new traditions? What are some new experience of value that having a more diverse community at Dartmouth has how the college has benefited? And I certainly think, and I, when I look at what the campus looks like today and the programs that are available that weren't even in existence when I was there from 1972 to 76, you know, I want to see as many African-American students and students of color be able to utilize those resources and that opportunity. So I think that's really what we all are still working towards and working for.
Definitely. So another thing that I wanted to ask about, something that came up in the Institutional Racism Student Life Report, was, you know, you guys quoted the McLean Report, which, actually, before I ask that question, can you give a recap of what the McLean Report was?
Off the top of my head, that was more something that Judy had that, one second, let me decline this call. I think that honestly, off the top of my head, I know that there were some concerns raised just about what was happening, I want to say, with students and their experiences, policies at the college, but 50 years, you know, I off the top of my head, I don't recall. So I would say that I would have to research that or look at it. I know that I was more focused on the climate that we were in and the conflicts and challenges that we were facing, that the faculty was facing, that African-Americans who played on the sports teams were facing. So that was more what I recall five decades later. But I know that Judy had done more of the research on what had been revealed in that.
Yeah. So, you know, there was a section of the McLean report that you guys quoted that basically said to avoid prejudice between Black and white students needed to be exposed to Black students. So I wanted to ask, do you believe that like exposure to Blackness helps white students at the college avoid prejudice? And have you ever like, I guess, seen that during your time at Dartmouth where like a white student learned more about Blackness and got over it?
So this is kind of what I think, or at least what I think we were getting at, is that there is an inherent assumption that when minorities come into a climate or a community where at that point we were the minorities, that we're looking to assimilate into the white culture. And I think what we were really getting at is no, that, you know, we want to engage in a collaborative sense in a community and have our cultural experiences valued. We want to have it recognized that we want to experience and retain practices in our cultural legacy, our political views, and our shared experiences. And that even if you didn't grow up in a community with Black people, as many of the white students that we were, you know, had in our classes, you know, that was just not their experience. I think that our point was that our culture, our holidays, our traditions, all that it be now infused and become more visible in what that collective community looks like. And so do I believe that there's a benefit to whites? I absolutely do believe it. And I'll make this point. There are programs that formally look to, you know, stimulate that engagement because the workforce that the students are gonna be part of once they graduate is diverse. The global marketplace is diverse and multicultural. So I think it's a matter of pragmatic reality that if you're not taking the opportunity in the college community to foster that cultural diversity, awareness, and celebration beyond what you know and beyond what you're comfortable with, of course, you know, we have that to contribute, and that should be recognized and valued. So I think that, you know, that is part of what I think we were getting at there, because, you know, we didn't see it there because the numbers weren't there. If you take a look at the Dartmouth Black graduates, just the list, and then you see when the numbers really start to blow up in terms of the 60s and 70s, you know, it becomes more realistic that that valuing of cultural experiences and visibility became a major issue when you're looking at 30, 40, 50 Blacks being on campus versus, you know, 3 in this class, 7 in that class, you know, and so I think that that was a reality of intentional recruitment. And just the progress that had been made in the 70s of what that Dartmouth class makeup looked like, that really begged the question that absolutely it should happen and it needs to continue to happen. And not just Black culture, Latino culture, Asian culture. You know, that is the global workplace that we're in now.
Yeah. So I know it might not have been very common given the time period and how different things were in America at the time. But do you remember any white students who did, I guess, openly show appreciation for Black culture while you were on campus?
You know, so I think that the question that you asked is a reasonable question, but living in the moment, you know, I could say Patti LaBelle and when the LaBelle came up there, the concert was sold out or was packed. You know, I look at just the events we had, the lectures we had, the controversy of some, I mean, when Malcolm X, when Richard Joseph brought Malcolm X, which was before my time up there, that was a major, they had some very major and controversial, interesting things with Black leadership and Black political figures that predated when I was up there in the 70s, that said to me that Dartmouth was a location where the resources to bring the best, the brightest in African-American minds, academic talent, whatever, the resources were there, but the greater community had mixed emotions about, you know, its value and its importance. I think that Blacks knew it and they pushed for it and they fought for it, and we continue to do that. And we have to continue to do that because nobody's going to really have the love of the need for our culture and our political sense of importance. You know, we have to be the driver for that. We can never feel that enough has been done. You know, we can never feel that when we've had a Black trustee serve as president, or that we have, you know, a large number, this number of progress or success, that we ever have to stop. We just can't stop, because I think when we feel comfortable and feel that we've done enough, then we're not really valuing the challenge that there are forces out there that are pushing back. So, you know, I look at that history and say, you know, yeah, it's been 50 years or be 50 years of the organization BADA and 50 years for co-education in 2022. But, you know, I feel like to this day, the struggle continues. Certainly George Floyd and the situations that occurred, you know, of recent times say that, and, you know, January 6th, you know, as another example, that, you know, we just can't ever feel too comfortable that there's an acceptance and a value of what the Black experience is.
Definitely. So I wanted to ask another thing that I thought about when I was going through the report that you guys wrote. So you talked about how it was difficult for some people to leave Dartmouth without, I guess, viewing non-white people and their cultures as less than, and that in turn that undermined the sense of community among Black students. Do you remember that? Like, do you have any specific memories of that happening?
So, I guess, you know, I would have to say that my personal experience was more rooted and surrounded within the Black community at Dartmouth. I would say between Monica, Judy, and myself, I was probably the most limited in how I looked at what was going on. In other words, you know, between academics, you know, being on an all Black cheerleading squad, you know, I guess I found ways that my comfort level for what my culture, my identity was, even in the midst of being in Hanover, I was able to seek it out and I was able to find it. So I would say that if anybody responds, now I will say, I know one thing I can give you as an example. I know that when we wound up having an all Black female basketball cheerleading squad, there was a pushback from the alumni. Some of them had issues. Well, why are they all Black women on the basketball squad? And it was because when we had that first squad and who came out to try out and the kinds of chairs or whatever, that first team was all Black females. And so the response that we got, you know, and I can't tell you, well, what was the uproar, how, because, you know, the feedback wouldn't have gone to us personally. It would have been more towards the college. But I was aware that there was pushback and issues raised about it. But I think if at the time the basketball team had been like a you know, championship team as the football team was, it would probably have been magnified even more. So that was an example to me of just that there were some issues that were in existence. And, You know, I'm saying, well, we're looking at a lot of all white groups, all white things by happenstance or whatever. So here's a situation where there's an all black group. And, you know, now all of a sudden you all are freaked out. So I think that those kinds of experiences just made me very aware that, you know, everything isn't fair. You know, everything isn't a fight, but it certainly is an opportunity to make sure that you have your voice, you know, you speak up and you seek the transparency of fact and information to whenever you raise your concerns. And I think that I can't speak for what different people's perceptions were in the larger community. I mean, I think if you look at the Praxis, if you look at the Dartmouth, there were a lot Dartmouth, you know, magazine or paper, newspaper. If you look at the some of the issues that were happening on campus at Dartmouth in the 70s, I think that, you know, that was really where your evidence of what was going on, you know, can really, you can really get a sense of it. But I was really on campus for 3 years. I spent my entire senior year off campus. So I had a very compact experience and view at Dartmouth. You know, I was at UCSD. I taught a term in Chicago at Pace Institute, Cook County Jail. So after I left Dartmouth, I know that they did a lot of tweaking of the Dartmouth plan, and you just couldn't be gone for an entire senior year the way we were. But I think that for those 3 years, 3.5 years that I was on campus, it was with a sense that Dartmouth really was a microcosm of the world and the country that, you know, we were experiencing at the time.
I understand. So I want to kind of connect this to something you brought up earlier. You said a lot of your friends, a lot of your male friends were football players. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, you know, since there's a section in the report dedicated to athletics, did they ever talk to you about that? And like, I guess, express how they felt?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of the frustrations and challenges that they had. So I guess I would make this disclaimer that if you're not playing in the sport and playing on the team, you're getting secondary information rather than being the primary source of experience. But I did, you know, get the sense of frustration that they would identify in just opportunities and how things went on. A lot of it was tied to coaching. And again, you know, not being in the locker room, not being in the team, and certainly not saying that I have a sense of sports strategy, because there are, you know, some women that love sports and are into it. I am not one of them. But I did certainly feel and get the sense in talking to them that, you know, they felt that, you know, certain things should be happening in a different way. Than what they were experiencing, an opportunity for playing and starting time and that kind of thing. And so those sentiments and the interviews and discussions that we did have with the guys certainly went and were tied and put into the report, because we felt that there was enough of those feelings that, you know, it deserved to be included as part of what we saw as, again, the threads of institutional racism that we were trying to identify, that we wanted to have looked at and examine.
Okay. So I think one of my last questions regarding the report specifically, you guys talked about the College Committee of Standing and Conduct, and an issue that you had with it was pretty difficult for Black students who were put, you know, to the committee to be judged by a jury of their peers, considering that Dartmouth was, you know,
right,
did not have a lot of Black students. So I wanted to ask, do you remember any Black students who had to deal with this? And did you ever, I guess, talk to them about their experience?
So I specifically, you know, do not recall the students that might've been specifically referred to in the report. I know that there was just a general feeling and discussion that anytime you go before a group where it is not representative of you, I mean, the judicial system, jury of your peers, You know, if I'm going before any group and appears the peers are considered not to include anybody of color, there's some issues there. I mean, and the same patterns can be seen when you look at who gets tenure and how that determination of tenure is made. Karen Turner is now, you know, a professor, a tenured professor at Temple. And so when we talk about these things, when we talk about who makes decisions, when groups get together, you know, it's the same old story when that group is not reflective in a broad sense of diversity, that the decisions are made from a very small context that depends on, you know, what those attitudes and thoughts are of you know, whites in power. And so I think that that's something that is just a timeless issue of concern. And I've seen it repeated in whatever industry you're in, whatever business you're trying to run, you know, you're applying for a loan at the bank, you know, you're going before a board, you know, for a review, your interview for a job. I mean, you know, the things that we've experienced, you know, we usually get a feeling when we, you know, we feel that perhaps that openness, that acceptance, that experience that we have is not consistent with somebody else. That, I mean, there's studies that have been done where, you know, Shanique has her name on the resume, and you know the other, you know, the Caucasian sounding name gets the interview or gets that acceptance. So, you know, there's enough scientific data that shows that the mindsets and personal prejudices that people have influence and limit opportunities for people of color. You know, I think it was true back then, 50 years ago, and I think it's true today.
Yeah, I also think not much has changed in that department. But so I guess this is my last question about the report specifically. So at the end, you guys outlined recommendations for how to remedy the problems that you brought up. Did you ever see any of those put into action before you graduated?
So, you know, when I think of the trustee committee's response, I would answer your question, you know, and certainly say that article, you know, which I can send you a copy of, says no. I think it was really like, we listened to them. We heard what they had to say. We established a committee. We found that, you know, their concerns were unfounded. And that was that. So I don't think it was. I think that in retrospect, the, you know, the fact that we didn't establish maybe a task force or we didn't have a task force and counter their committee response with now a task force of the Black alumni of Dartmouth made up of the alumni. As I look at strategy and perseverance, I would say, if you said, what's the one thing that you would do over? It's really the understanding that don't expect that there's gonna be the change that, you know, just presenting the information is gonna resolve. That you've gotta come back and say, you've said this is unfounded. Well, let's dig a little deeper and see if your conclusion is valid. And so that to me is, if I could go back in time and do something over, it would have been that is one of several reports, and maybe the report gets done annually. Maybe the review gets established with a task force that pushes for certain of those certain recommendations outlined in it. So I think that, you know, we moved on with life. Like I said, I was off campus a whole senior year. So, you know, it was in a moment of just our need to speak up and speak out. But I do see now in retrospect that this kind of issue, this kind of challenge is a continuing move of strategy and perseverance, because there's not gonna be, it's very unusual for there to be people just accepting, well, you know, we looked at it, you're right, you got us, well, you know, this is what we can do to fix it. I mean, You know, it's that's it would be nice if it worked like that, but that's just unrealistic.
Yeah. So another thing that you wrote with Monica Hargrove and Judy Redding was Open Letter to the Black Community, which was a poem in the Black Praxis magazine. First, did the three of you write a lot together? Like, was it just more than these two pieces?
So the reason why I chuckle when you say that is Judy recently shared that piece with me, you know, kind of passing back. And then we started talking and you know, I said, well, Judy, I went back and I found a letter that you wrote to me. And she said, well, I have a letter that you wrote to me. So I think that opportunities for us to collaborate were not frequent, but when, you know, those two examples, I don't really recall that there were a lot more of those instances or occurrences, but I think that we probably in the whole process that was evolving as we wrote the report, as we felt the need to communicate, we all then, I think, after those few collaborative instances, you know, went on our ways to personally pursue things or, you know, to be part of it. We, you know, we became active when the Black Alumni of Dartmouth organization was formed. You know, we were part of those things. I want to say Karen Turner, I believe, was the first female who was president of the Black Alumni of Dartmouth. And so I look at that and say that, you know, when I ran for president of the African American Society, I think that those were examples of, okay, we've raised the consciousness, our consciousness has been raised, what are we gonna do? And I think that's really when more of doing and seeing results, getting results, because if we're not leading those results, it's not going to happen. It's not going to be done for us. There's not going to be an acknowledgement and a change. And I think that that's really when I would say the, you know, boots on the ground activism in our own different ways started to manifest.
Okay. So on the poem and, like, you know, talking about results, what kind of effect did it have on the Black community? And did it have the result that you were aiming for?
Well, you know, and that's a hard question because without taking a formal survey, you know, where we took a measurement of attitudes, you know, preceding that action, you know, then, you know, the same survey to see if there were any changes. I think that I personally had a sense, and it was probably because of the formation, the formalizing of the Black Alumni of Dartmouth Association, that I felt that that establishment of BADA was really the impetus for us coming together as a group and also saying we owe it not just to deal with the issues of, you know, Black retention and recruitment, but to also hear what these students are dealing with on campus. And there's so many of us now, we're in the thousands. Back then it was a lot less, but there was always a sense that whatever our experience was, because it was very varied for many individuals, that there was a sense of paying it forward and always making sure that whatever Black students were dealing with on campus, whatever Black faculty were challenged with, you know, feeling the need that they needed to move on to become whatever, that the opportunities weren't necessarily there, there was always a sense that was our mission. And so that to me was how I would say we came together. But, you know, over the span of time, over the span of decades, there's, you know, it's risen and it's, you know, been lowered in terms of maybe what that activism level and the effectiveness of the organization might have been. You know, I think that when you get very large in numbers, I always remember when I, you know, was taking some of the business courses, that it's easy to be innovative in a small model and something that, you know, starts out, but it's scaling up. That's the hard part. establishing those best practices and managing them in a much broader context, that's where the, you know, the devil is in the details. And I think that that's some of the challenges we face now. We have so many phenomenal Black alumni had success and paid it forward and, you know, been part of the organization and been involved with students and mentoring and other things. And it's just hard to manage the large network that is now and say, well, are we still being responsive? Are we still being on task? So I'm looking forward to 2022. I'm looking forward to the 50th anniversary. I've already got my hotel reservation squared away. Transportation's a little shaky at this point because, you know, Manchester rent car rentals are, you know, they're accepting gold bars as payment. But, you know, I'm looking forward to get back there. And I'm also looking forward just to celebrate those of us who are still able to come together and you know, share community and challenges with one another.
Yeah, that's absolutely something worth celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's insane to think, like you guys are coming up on 50 years. That's just still so amazing to me.
At least 50 years old, right? And I'm still fighting that. Yes, I am. But okay.
Yeah. So, Open Letter to the Black Community was published in the Black Praxis magazine. So I wanted to ask, was this the only piece you published in the Praxis?
This is the only. Well, I know I had an interview right after we had the meeting with the trustees. So that's the only two things that I recall that were in the Praxis that I was directly involved in.
Got it. So I guess now I want to talk more about, you know, your life after Dartmouth. So what did you do after you graduated?
Oh, I've been a rolling stone. So after I graduated, I moved to Chicago. I got a job with United Airlines in marketing and sales promotion. And that was like a one span of one segment of my career. And I have to admit that I loved the travel benefits. I loved, you know, the art that you see that I've created on the back of the wall is really the reflection of being able to travel worldwide. And this, I call it the Celebration of Life series. And so, but my careers have always been, and I think this is one of the things that time at Dartmouth, and then also getting out of school at 19, I've had many different careers. I've been in the airline industry. I worked for a global travel management company. And then for the last 15, 16 years, I've been an educator, a visual arts educator. And so I look at that experience and happily, I'm gonna be retiring from education July 1st of 2022.
And congratulations.
Thank you, because it's time for my next chapter, you know, but I see my next chapter as going back to the art studio and traveling and, you know, enjoying my family, my friends. So my life has been just a series of, you know, enjoying the experiences and the opportunities, but also understanding that in the process of that success, you always have to play a role in making things better, in being a value, of being an advocate, of being a voice for those who may not be in the same situation or the position to affect change and transformation the way you can. You know, and you do that knowing that there are consequences, but I always believe, and I mean, I've always experienced that when one door closes and nothing is on the horizon, and you're like, boy, this is, you know, a zip, bam, another door is gonna open. I mean, that's been my life experience. So, you know, it's kind of coming to a point at 65, going on 66, where, we're in some dark times now. You know, I mean, seriously, you know, with the network of friends I have, we're talking about, you know, citizenship in another country and what's going to happen with the 2024 election. And is there going to be, you know, a civil war with the next election? Because 50% of the country is going to deny the outcome. But, you know, I mean, so I look at it and say, in one sense, it's the darkest hour. But in another sense, you know, I'm just excited about the opportunity in the short term of having my time and my freedom and flexibility back once again. You know, so it was kind of like that period right out of Dartmouth where I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do career-wise before I started working for United Airlines. You know, just really being grateful for that opportunity to experience the world and just experience the culture and just, you know, what friends and family are about. And so that's been the life after Dartmouth.
Sounds amazing. Did you do a lot of traveling before Dartmouth?
No, you know, interestingly, I did. And because of the choices that I made, I did not go into any of the study abroad programs. I did go to the transfer at UCSD. So in my senior year, that fall term, I was out at UCSD. And then I was at Pace Institute tutoring at Cook County Jail. And then I went back for graduation in June of 76. So it wasn't until I got the opportunity to work for United Airlines that I realized how much I love travel. I mean, and then I worked for US Airways for a bit of time too. And I literally, and let's face it, if you know anything about Chicago winters, I would get up early in the morning Saturday and pack for the Bahamas and overnight it and come back Sunday night. And I just needed that recharge from the extreme winter weather that, you know, Chicago is still known to have. So for me, travel and, you know, just being able to go to some destinations, you know, has really, the only thing I've never done, which is still my life goal, is I have not traveled to Africa. You know, I've been to Europe, Asia, South America. I have not made that trip. So that's kind of on my bucket list of things that I want to enjoy. I had a trip planned. Because there was an arts festival in Africa, and of course it was in 2020, right?
Of course.
I mean, seriously, I was like, oh, I mean, and somebody else was paying for it. That was the irony. And then I just said, okay, as another door closes, another one will open. But that just really kind of, I was like, what? Are you kidding? I said, no, cancel. So that's kind of on my list of things I want to do still.
Okay. This is a little bit, derailing. So the paintings in the back, did you do those while you were traveling or did you do them when you came back?
A little bit of both. I mean, so I really got into the art and painting after I was at United and more kind of getting into the family. I have two sons, Jordan and Romare. So when I was settling more into the domestic mom thing and I was anchored a little bit more, so there was less travel and less desire to travel. But when I traveled, I had lots of photos. And so I would say while I was at United, I did have art shows when I was in Chicago. I did start my interest in the art business, but it was really more in the 90s. And I live here in Hydesville, which is part of the Gateway Arts District in Prince George's County. And so all around me are galleries. And I have done work as a consultant for the Prince George's Arts and Humanities Council. So kind of where the merger of the classroom and the merger of my own interests. So I've been writing curriculum on social justice curriculum and dealing with arts integration, but with integration of social justice and global competency. So now my interest in leaving the classroom and retiring in the classroom is to continue as a consultant and really look to continue utilizing museum resources, programs, issues on immigration, broadening the knowledge and awareness of artists of color in a curriculum that is Eurocentric. So that's kind of my interest now. And then also just to continue with my own painting and art, which really has last couple of years.
I want to ask, how did you originally get into painting and just art in general?
So I was, that was what my major at Dartmouth was in.
Like, how did you choose that?
Studios down there, but it was interesting. I majored in it there because it was a natural talent and it came easily to me. So I said, okay, well, I can be successful at that. But then the pragmatic side of me always sought out corporate jobs because I wanted that income level. So I always had two or more things that I was doing at the same time my entire career. You know, that's why I always joke when people said, well, you know, you got to do this or you got to go after this. And, you know, I just say, whatever you're passionate about, don't let anybody sidetrack you or talk you into anything else. Pursue your passion, even if you have to also do something else to help support that pursuit. So, but I've just been painting for, I would say most of this work, I counted them for insurance purposes. There are 100 pieces of art in my house. But my son, my youngest son, Romier, named after Romier Bearden, he is also a talented painter. And so some of the pieces in here are his that I would not let him take to his place yet. But, you know, the expression and the creation of art, collage, painting with acrylics, it's like just really been my strength. So.
That's amazing. And I'm just, those pieces are really beautiful. I especially like the, I think it's on a beach and like a bunch of people on the sand there.
Sorry, I was trying to figure out that this
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, that was inspired by the Mocha Jumbies you can pick your island. Of course, Trinidad and Tobago will claim that that's the only place, but the Bahamas and other places, Barbados, everybody has it. But those really are more reflective of what I've done. These are some of the other pieces over here. I have collage pieces. Let's see, these are some of my other collages. So you've got the tour here, the book club, the spa in California, the garden scene outdoors. So
those are all really beautiful. I thank you for the mini tour.
Sure.
So I think my last question is, how has your perception of Dartmouth changed from like now versus when you were a student?
Oh. Okay. How has it changed? I'm not so sure that it changed. I think, although let me say it a little bit differently. I think I, as an adult, a seasoned adult, a senior citizen, see and value the benefit and the contribution that I've made to Dartmouth. And I think that I still look at it and have a love of the college because of the fact that, you know, it was such a formative and critical part of who I am and what I am and what I've turned out and grown up to be and pursue. So I recognize that, but I feel that possibly the difference now is I understand how the need for me to be involved and to be part of the Dartmouth community and to make a contribution as an alumni and act, you know, may not be in the financial numbers that some of my more lucrative fellow alum can do, but I can certainly be a voice, be involved, be on campus, be active in the Black Alumni Dartmouth organization. And I think the sense of belonging and the value and importance of being part of that is greater now than it was back then. You know, I saw it as something like, I was there, we, you know, did the report, you know, there were issues of concern. And then I kind of got into life and being part of life. But now I look at that institution and I see that there's still a part of me that's connected and a role of value and influence that I also want to have for what I've, you know, gotten to and what I am now able to provide in that role and in that capacity. I mean, I love the fact now that you all are putting together courses that are looking at the history of what has happened. You know, when we had the Black Alumni of Dartmouth Conference where we went to the graves of the slaves and that were on campus, buried on campus, that was a piece that when I was up there, I wasn't even aware of it. You know, more astute alumni had known the history, had researched the history of Dartmouth and African Americans at Dartmouth. But that whole history has been more discovery and learning as a lot of the alumni have brought forward their documents, their evidence, and this whole issue of transparency. So I like being involved in the process of sharing that history, of promoting that history and encouraging our students to learn about really what has come before them that makes the institution what it is that you all are experiencing now.
Yeah. I think we can wrap up here. I want to say thank you so much, not only for agreeing to do this interview, but for what you've contributed to the college, because I can confidently say without, you know, the experiences of Black students like you and Black alumni, my experience would not nearly be as enjoyable as it is now. So genuinely, I want to thank you so much for that.
Well, you're very welcome. And I also want to thank you for your courage and your interest, because, you know, you've made some decisions and made some sacrifices in even pursuing this that you should be commended for, because realizing and being part of something at your young stage means that you've got nowhere to go but up and more success beyond here. So I'm, you know, thank you for your efforts as well.
So I'm gonna stop the recording here.
Okay.